I want you to picture a bar of steel. It's glowing orange hot, sitting on a factory floor, just cooling down in the air. To the naked eye, it's passive. It's just getting darker, colder, nothing to see here. And
That's
I'm.
what it looks like from the outside.
Yeah.
But if you could shrink yourself down to the atomic level, you wouldn't see a cooling rock.
No.
You would see a battlefield.
I'm a battlefield.
Absolute chaos. Trillions of atoms are frantically rearranging themselves, fighting for space, snapping into new formations, and releasing massive amounts of energy.
Wow.
And the winner of that war determines whether that bar becomes a bridge that stands for a century or a bracket that snaps the first time you put a load on it.
And that is exactly what we are unpacking today. We're doing a deep dive into a PhD thesis by Lei Guo from the University of Cambridge, The Mission.
The mission was to take that atomic chaos and predict the future of a piece of steel using a computer model called structure.
Specifically, we're looking at silicon-containing bainitic free machining steel.
Which is a mouthful, I know.
It is a mouthful, but we're going to break down why every single word in that name matters. Because the whole idea here is that for a long time, metallurgy was kind of, well, cooking.
It was empirical. Cook and look, we call it.
Right. A dash of this, heat it to that, cross your fingers.
You make it, you break it, and if it fails, you change the recipe. But Guo's work, supervised by Professor HKDH Padatia, is trying to move us from cooking to true engineering,
To prediction.
to prediction. The goal is to simulate the physics so accurately that we know the steel's properties before we even melt the ore.
So let's go back to that glowing bar. It starts as something called austenite. I see this term everywhere in the research. What is it really? Why is that the starting line?
Well, austenite is the parent phase. It only exists at high temperatures.
Go ahead.
Imagine the iron atoms stacked like oranges in a crate. That's a face-centered cubic structure. The key thing is that geometry leaves little gaps between the iron atoms.
And that's where the carbon goes.
That's where carbon loves to hide.
So austenite is basically a sponge for carbon.
Exactly. But as the bar cools, the iron atoms want to rearrange into something called ferrite.
And ferrite is different.
Very different. It's a body-centered cubic structure. The atoms pack differently, tighter in some ways. And crucially, ferrite hates carbon. It has almost no room for it.
So the temperature drops, the iron tries to shift shape to get comfortable, but it has to do something with all this carbon it's holding.
And that's the race. As the steel cools, different crystal structures, these different phases, start competing to take over that volume.
And they all have different strategies for dealing with the carbon.
Exactly. The thesis lays them out so clearly. You've got the polite ones first.
Allotriomorphic ferrite.
Right. This is the slow and steady builder. It nucleates and grows at the grain boundaries. It's a reconstructive transformation.
Meaning the atoms actually move one by one.
They literally break bonds and move individually to build a new lattice. It's orderly, diffusive. It takes its time.
Okay, then you have perlite.
Perlite is a cooperative effort. It's layers of ferrite and cementite, which is a hard carbide growing together.
Like a layer cake.
It is. The ferrite rejects the carbon, and the cementite just eats it up. They grow in sync, like a little layer cake expanding through the material.
But then things get violent. The thesis talks about displacive transformations.
Yes.
Widmanstetten ferrite and bainite. Displacive just sounds aggressive.
It is. Instead of atoms moving one by one, whole blocks of the crystal lattice shear at once.
Nope.
Just like that. It's like a deck of cards sliding over.
Yeah.
It happens at the speed of sound relative to the atomic spacing.
So the atoms don't have time to diffuse?
The iron atoms don't. They just shift. But, and here is the twist for bainite, which is the focus of this study. The carbon still has to move.
Ah.
Bainite is this weird hybrid. The iron lattice snaps into place like a soldier, but then it has to wait for the carbon to diffuse out before it can grow the next bit.
So you have all these different phases, the polite builders versus the violent snappers, and the problem Guo's trying to solve is that they don't wait their turn.
Correct. In the real world, they're all trying to happen at once.
Simultaneous transformation.
Simultaneous transformation. Most older models would calculate them sequentially. First ferrite. Then if that stops, maybe perlite starts. But in reality, perlite might be eating up the carbon just as bainite is trying to nucleate.
They're fighting over the same food source and the same real estate.
Exactly.
How do you even model that? It sounds like calculating a three-way car crash in slow motion. If you have to track every boundary moving against every other boundary, the computing power required must be insane.
It would be. If you tried to calculate the exact geometry of every crystal bumping into every other crystal in 3D space, it would take a supercomputer years for a single bar of steel. So the thesis uses this clever mathematical trick.
The extended volume concept.
Yeah.
This part reminded me of, like, video game physics.
It's a bit like that. Imagine you let the crystals grow as phantoms. They don't check for collisions.
So they can grow right through each other.
They can grow through each other. They can grow infinitely. That math is easy because you don't have to check for boundaries.
Okay, so you have these ghost crystals overlapping everywhere. But that's not reality.
No, but then you apply a statistical correction. You use probability theory. From Kolmogorov, Johnson, Mel, and Avrami, and you ask, what is the probability that this phantom growth actually landed in empty, untransformed space?
Oh, I see. So if the material is 50% transformed, there's only a 50% chance that any new phantom growth is real.
Precisely. It converts a nightmare geometry problem into a manageable probability problem.
Mm-hmm.
And Guo's model breaks time into tiny little steps to calculate these nucleation and growth rates dynamically.
So that gives you the growth rates. But here is the part of the thesis that really surprised me, the feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
We usually think the air cools the steel and the steel changes, cause and effect. The environment acts on the metal.
Right. That's the standard assumption.
But the thesis says the steel fights back. It heats itself up.
This is the phenomenon of recalcitrance.
Yeah.
And historically, blacksmiths saw this. They'd watch a cooling piece of iron get dark, and then suddenly, without going back in the fire, it would glow bright orange again.
It looked like magic.
Must have. But it's just physics.
Just thermodynamics.
It's thermodynamics.
Yeah.
When austenite turns into ferrite or bainite, it goes from a higher energy state to a lower one.
Hmm.
It has to dump that excess energy as heat, latent heat.
And we aren't talking about a tiny amount of heat. I think usually when we hear latent heat, we think of ice melting. It's subtle. But Guo's model found the temperature of the bar can jump back up by 30 to 80 degrees Celsius.
Which is huge in the world of metallurgy.
It's massive.
Imagine you're trying to predict the structure, assuming the bar is at 400 degrees. At 400, you expect bainite. But actually, because of the transformation heat, the bar has heated itself back up to 480.
And at 480, bainite might not form at all.
Exactly. You're in a completely different zone. You might stop getting bainite and start getting perlite again. Or the transformation might just stall entirely.
So if your computer model doesn't account for the steel heating itself up, your prediction isn't just slightly off.
It's useless.
It's completely useless.
You cannot separate the heat transfer model from the phase transformation model. They are coupled. The structure changes the temperature, and the temperature changes the structure. That is the real aha moment in Guo's work.
Okay, let's zoom in on bainite, because that's the star of this particular steel. The thesis calls bainite an incomplete reaction. That sounds like a failure. Did it just give up?
It's not a failure, but it is a standoff.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, bainite grows by that violent shearing mechanism, but it stops growing before the carbon levels reach equilibrium. It hits a wall.
A wall called the T0 prime line?
The T0 prime line, yeah.
Okay, break that down for us without the calculus.
Okay. The bainite wants to grow into the austenite. But growing requires energy, especially because that shearing action creates a lot of strain-like stretching a rubber band.
Right.
As the austenite gets richer and richer in carbon, it becomes more chemically stable. So eventually, the chemical push to turn into bainite isn't strong enough to overcome the strain pushback.
So it just stops,
yeah.
Even if there's space left.
It freezes. Even though there is plenty of austenite left, the reaction halts.
Yeah.
You're left with this carbon-rich austenite that just won't transform into bainite anymore.
And inside this bainite, there is another race happening.
Yes.
This is the difference between upper bainite and lower bainite. I always thought this was just about temperature upper forms at higher temps.
Temperature drives it, but the mechanism is a race between two processes. You have a freshly formed plate of ferrite that is chock full of carbon. It's supersaturated. The carbon is unhappy.
Okay.
It has two escape routes. Route A, leak out into the surrounding austenite.
Oh.
And route B, group together inside the plate and form little cementite crystals.
Precipitation.
So it's a competition.
So if it leaks out fast enough, you get clean plates of ferrite. That's upper bainite.
Exactly. But if the precipitation is faster than the leak, the carbon gets trapped and forms carbides inside the plates. And that's lower bainite.
And this is where the specific recipe of the steel comes in. The thesis focuses heavily on silicon. Why is silicon the key ingredient here?
Silicon is the game changer. Silicon inhibits cementite. It basically throws a wrench in the gears of carbide formation. It prevents route B.
So if you add silicon, the carbon can't form carbide inside the plate easily.
Right. The carbon can't precipitate, so it has more time to leak out. This forces the steel to form upper bainite, even at temperatures where you might normally get lower bainite.
But that leaking carbon has to go somewhere.
It piles up in the remaining austenite.
Which stabilizes that austenite even more, and this leads to something called retained austenite.
Yes. Even at room temperature, you have pockets of the high temperature phase trapped in the steel.
Now, usually, having soft spots in your hard steel sounds like a bad thing. If I'm building a drive shaft, I don't want soft, mushy austenite in there.
You wouldn't think so.
But the thesis mentions the tree IP effect.
In this context, retained austenite is a superpower. Tree IP stands for transformation-induced plasticity.
Okay.
If you stress the material, say, in a car crash, the retained austenite finally snaps and turns into martensite.
So it absorbs the impact energy to fuel the transformation.
Exactly. That transformation absorbs energy. It makes the steel tougher and more ductile exactly when you need it to be. It prevents the steel from just shattering.
But Guo points out a catch. Size matters.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just have big blobs of austenite.
No. Huge blocks of retained austenite are unstable. They'll turn into brittle martensite too easily, maybe just from the vibration of the machine or cooling down too fast. They don't wait for the crash.
Do you want fine films or small blocks?
That's the key.
And I love the visual the thesis used for calculating this size, the random division theory.
It's such a great geometric model.
Yeah.
Imagine a block of cheese. That's your original austenite grain.
Okay.
Now imagine slicing it randomly with a knife. Those are the bainite plates forming.
Chop, chop.
Every chop divides the volume into smaller and smaller compartments. Guo's model assumes this happens randomly. It predicts exactly how small those leftover blocks of cheese, the retained austenite, will be.
And it works.
And amazingly, this random chopping model matches the experimental data perfectly for high-carbon steels.
It's so satisfying when a simple probability theory maps onto atomic reality so cleanly.
It really is.
But let's shift gears. We've built the steel structure, but this thesis also talks about adding, well, dirt.
Controlled dirt, manganese sulfide.
M&S. This brings us to the free machining part of the title.
Right. If you are machining a part, drilling it, cutting it on a lathe, you don't want the steel to peel off in long, continuous gummy ribbons.
No, they clog up the robots. They're dangerous. They can ruin the surface finish.
Exactly. You want the metal to chip off cleanly. So you add sulfur to create these little M&S particles that act as breakpoints in the steel matrix.
But putting these particles in the steel messes with the structure, right? The thesis looks at how these particles pin the grain boundaries.
Yeah, they act like anchors, stopping the grains from growing too big.
This is Zener pinning.
That's it. But there was a specific finding here about shape versus volume that I think is the key takeaway for this section.
It is so counterintuitive. We usually model particles as spheres because the math is easy.
Of course. A sphere is a simple shape.
But M&S often forms as long rods.
And Guo found that a rod is much, much better at stopping a grain boundary than a sphere.
Even if they have the same volume.
Even then. Think of it this way. If you are trying to stop a crowd of people, that's the grain boundary, from moving forward, what works better? A big beach ball on the ground or a long horizontal pole at waist height?
The pole, obviously. It spans more width.
Exactly. The rod has a higher probability of intersecting the boundary. The thesis showed that even if you chopped the rod into a line of spheres with the same total volume, the solid rod is still more effective.
So geometrically, a long inclusion is a stronger anchor.
Much stronger. This means if you can control the shape of these sulfide inclusions, perhaps by how you roll or deform the steel, you can control the grain size of the steel much more efficiently than just by adding more sulfur.
That is a detail you would completely miss if you were just modeling everything as average spheres.
And that precision carries over to the final update in the structure model that Guo tackled.
The perlite problem.
The perlite problem. Apparently, the old structure program had a blind spot. It wasn't predicting perlite growth correctly in these complex steels.
Why not?
The old model treated perlite growth as a binary system, iron and carbon. But this steel has manganese, and that creates a tortoise and hare situation.
Carbon is the hare.
Carbon is the hare. It's small, it's fast, it zips through the lattice. Manganese is the tortoise. It's a substitutional atom, meaning it has to swap places with iron atoms. It moves very, very slowly.
So the old model couldn't reconcile how perlite grows when one ingredient moves a million times slower than the other.
It couldn't. If you wait for the manganese to diffuse through the volume of the crystal, perlite would basically never grow. But we know it does grow.
So how did they fix it? Where is the manganese going?
They realized they had to model diffusion along the boundary interface. The atoms don't just swim through the crystal lattice, that's volume diffusion. They also run along the boundary itself.
Like a highway on the edge of the crystal?
That's a perfect analogy. Boundary diffusion is much, much faster. By incorporating a model that accounts for both the fast carbon and the slow manganese moving along the interface, they found a tie line, an equilibrium where the system is happy.
And suddenly the predictions matched reality.
Yes. It showed that the no partition temperature, where the phases grow without changing composition, was accurately predicted only when you included this boundary effect.
So pulling this all together, we've gone from phantom crystals to self-heating bars to rod-shaped impurities. What is the big picture here? Why does this specific thesis matter to someone who isn't a metallurgist?
It matters because it validates the digital twin concept for materials. Go didn't just fit a curve to data points. He modeled the actual physical mechanisms, the heat, the geometry, the diffusion.
Which means we can stop guessing.
We can design steel on a laptop.
Right.
If you want a steel that is easier to machine but maintains high ductility for a car bumper, you can tweak the silicon or the manganese in the model and see the microstructure evolve before you ever turn on a furnace.
It saves energy. It saves time.
And it lets us push the material to its absolute theoretical limits.
It's the difference between a chef tasting the soup and a chemist calculating the soup.
That's a great way to put it.
Speaking of limits, though, I want to leave you with a thought from the very end of the thesis. It's about that silicon again.
The thermodynamic riddle.
We know silicon stops cementite from forming. We use it for that purpose. That's why we get that nice bainite. But the thesis points out something unsettling. We don't actually know the thermodynamics of silicon inside cementite.
Because it's so insoluble. It hates being there so much that we can't effectively measure the energy state of it.
It's a ghost.
It is. We know it doesn't like it, but we don't know exactly how much it doesn't like it.
So here is the provocative question. We are building these incredible models based on the fact that silicon stays out. But if we could crack that riddle, if we could understand the physics of that forbidden combination, what new properties are hiding behind that door?
That is the frontier. And that's why researchers like Guo are still essential. No matter how good the computers get, there are still ghosts in the machine.
Thanks for taking this deep dive with us into the microstructure of steel. We'll see you next time.